Hello, and welcome to Unquestionably Nerdy, the show where we talk about everything that makes us want to geek out, freak out, and punish our players with a TPK. I am one of your hosts, Cata MacArthur, and whom am I joined by?
Well, you're joined by the color commentator and probably the most brutal DM to ever exist, Cole Browning.
That's not an inaccurate statement, yeah. Well, Cole, we're starting off well talking about a certain game. And what game would that be, Mr. Browning?
One of the few things I actually know about this podcast, Dungeons & Dragons.
Excellent. Indeed we are. We are talking about Dungeons & Dragons. It is a game that has been around since the 70s, and it has been a way for nerds to hide away in their mother's basements, and also for famous voice actors to get rich on Twitch. But today, it's just a way that two friends have connected over the past several years since senior year of high school, and we're going to talk about it. So, I figured, Cole, that we could start with a little bit of background on what D&D is, what its history is, and just provide a basis of context for our millions and millions of viewers.
Well, I can give you part of the base history. D&D was created sometime in the 70s. It was the brainchild of the wonderful Gary Gygax. And
yes.
The other big thing you have to know, it's gone through quite a few editions. There was regular D&D, advanced D&D, 3rd edition, 3.5, 4th edition, and then now we're on 5th edition.
Correct.
And most all of them, except for probably 5th edition, have in some way been intertwined with the lore of worshipping Satan. But I can promise you that we are not Satan worshippers. There may be some Satanists in the audience, but I can also promise you those aren't Satan worshippers.
All true, I think. Yeah.
You don't bring me on for the truth. You bring me on for the random things I say.
That's exactly why I brought you here, Cole, yes. But you're totally right. The Dungeons & Dragons system was brought to life by Gary Gygax in the 70s, based off another tabletop war game called Chainmail. It was a system created by Gygax and Jeff Perrin and Dave Arneson, associates of Gygax and fellow wargamers. Obviously, when D&D started out as a sort of spin-off of Chainmail, this early war game system, there was really a lot less to it. It focused much more on the war game aspect, so much less of the fantasy and the, you know, high magic system, and more just on units v units. But eventually the system and the story would evolve with the first settings. Gygax would base the original concepts and monsters in D&D heavily off of settings like Tolkien's Middle Earth. Obviously, you see a lot of inspiration there. Arneson, Dave Arneson, would be the one to create the Blackmoor system and would play in the setting for D&D with Gygax. And interesting note about Blackmoor as a setting, it had a lot of sci-fi inspiration, which we do see in D&D as well, with systems like Pathfinder and Spelljammer, and settings like Eberron, with a more technological aspect to them, and recent innovations in classes like the Artificer. But eventually Gygax himself would create Greyhawk as his own setting, basing it off of real history of Earth and using a repurposed map of Earth to create his nations.
Repurposed map of Earth?
Yes, the original setting of Greyhawk was based on Earth.
That's insane. Gygax, yes. Gygax definitely kind of knew what he was doing with that, or at least made it easy on himself. Every single time I've tried to come up with a homebrew campaign, I kind of put a pencil and start scribbling lines until I get a shape. And I'm like, ah, yes, that's a continent.
Yeah, that's a river, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're totally right. Gygax was a big history nerd, and you can obviously see that in the inspiration he drew for his settings and the way Perrin and Arneson built the system. But once the system was built and sort of made for the three of them and their friends and families, they eventually tried to bring it to a wider audience. But D&D was rejected by several game producers. So Gygax and company would go on to found TSR, otherwise known as Tactical Studies Rules. They'd founded this company back in the early days of D&D in order to produce Dungeons & Dragons themselves. And obviously in the modern day, we have several inspirations from other companies and organizations. In the modern day, it has really become a way to diversify D&D.
Man, I really gotta say, you've done your homework for this episode.
I try. I have to feel smart in comparison to you somehow, Cole. For those listening at home, Cole is generally the smarter of the two of us, but occasionally I have to throw him off his game somehow.
I was going to say I'm a physicist, but I'm also the one that was most prone to just kind of talk about horny bards for half of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone remembers, yes, musical instruments and horny bards are 50% of all D&D. You always have that one member in the party that is going to try to seduce the dragon.
Absolutely. We've had many of them.
Well, I don't think we've had them seduce the dragon. Have one try to seduce, mm-hmm, I think, an undead. That was fun.
Seduce an undead. Had one who tried to seduce a fey princess.
I'm currently seducing death. Like, the actual, like, Sandman endless version of death in the campaign. And funny enough, I'm not a ranger. I'm actually a guitar-playing ranger.
Well, enough about Cole's personal life. Let's get back to the actual magic. And the magic system of early D&D, based heavily off of Jack Vance's series The Dying Earth, a fantasy setting that Gygax and Co. were huge fans of. And that's kind of where you get the idea of a certain level of magic that you can use per day. And in the modern edition of D&D, we see that in the system for spell slots. Though it was different back in the day, of course. And the Dying Earth series by Jack Vance would go on to influence lots of D&D, including Vecna, as Vance's last name is rearranged into Vecna, one of D&D's greatest villains and villain of the latest season of Stranger Things, obviously.
Vecna's just up there as one of the best. I was going to say, mm-hmm, as you guys, if you've watched the previous episode, you know that Strahd and Vecna are kind of our top two, I think, for the intelligent, you know, big bads of
mm-hmm,
any D&D campaign. I think they're kind of the staples of what current players, especially newer players, would know about, especially, you know, those coming in the 5th edition. But
mm-hmm,
I really didn't know that about the Vecna just kind of being an anagram of the guy's last name.
Yes, indeed.
You're going to inspire me just to make a villain for my next campaign that's just called Elok now.
Elok. I can't wait to fight him, I guess. I don't know.
You won't have to fight him. He'll also be a horny bard. So he will just try to seduce you.
Oh, good. I can't wait to keep 10 feet away from him at all times. Well, with more information on the early settings of D&D, we have, in addition to the magic system, we have the races. While much of the focus and mechanical favor was put on humans, there were Tolkien-esque options, including dwarves, elves, and hobbits, before hobbits were changed to halflings due to conflict with the Tolkien estate. All of the non-human races had certain abilities that made them more powerful early on, but could only advance to a certain level. So non-human races actually had level caps. They couldn't go above a certain level like humans could, which certainly played into the idea that while humans are not as naturally strong, graceful, or magical, they did possess higher potential. And you see that a lot in many settings where humans are often the younger race, the less experienced race, the more arrogant race even. It is humans that have the most potential in a lot of settings and stories.
Yeah, I definitely think that that comes back to the humans are the ones playing the game.
Yes.
I personally don't know any elves or dwarves that play D&D. If I did, I think I may be crazy.
Oh, well.
But I definitely think that if it wasn't a marketing ploy, it was kind of to endorse that kind of narrative of, look, the people that you're playing in this game have the potential to excel to these crazy levels, so do you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons that the humans didn't have that level cap. But I mean,
yeah,
I will say D&D is kind of that thing that now, since the races don't have the level cap,
mm-hmm.
I think it's a big thing now that it's kind of boring to play a human.
Yeah, I was about to say, like,
I was gonna say humans it's ironic. Still one of the best races.
Yeah, it's ironic that back in the day, humans were seen as the heroic race by Gygax and the others. And nowadays, you get so many people online that go, well, why would you want to play a human when you can play something so unique and colorful and whatever? And you're right. If you play a human right, they're just as powerful as any other race. Yeah. Especially with the newer settings that allow more and more freedom as to how you build them.
Yeah, I mean, the humans are still great. But I think that coining it kind of how it's unique with the different races, I think that gets into how unique is it really with the big of why would you want to play a human. Big D&D mm-hmm. argument now is dark vision. And
yes, why discussed a lot.
Why would you want to play a race that doesn't have dark vision?
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen a lot of arguments that are just like, oh, people don't, you know, play dark vision right, or like the DMs don't, you know, acknowledge it in the right way, because it's only supposed to be, you know, like a black and mm-hmm. white television.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think other than mechanically, I do think that the other races kind of just have a bit more interesting stories to them now, on just kind of mm-hmm. how like their tribes and racial structures work, since you kind of have the Goliaths now, the Firbolgs. My favorite, because we're talking about kind of mimicking history, you have the Hobgoblins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who are just the Mongols.
Yes.
They're just the Mongols, and one character idea I've still yet to play, but is kind of in my top three, is a Hobgoblin Cavalier.
Mm-hmm.
That just it's the fighter that just rides around on a horse, but has a stupid strong bow. And I'm like, that character is the definitive Mongol.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think it's crazy as much history that they've put in it now. That
mm-hmm.
that human kind of has become the boring one.
Yeah, you're right. Like, there are, in the modern day there of D&D, there's so much story revolving around the other races, with the dwarves and the elves and the empires of old from long dead races and the progenitor races and whatever. It really often does feel like humans kind of fall to the wayside, which is ironic considering the inspirations for D&D's early stories and how important humans were back then. But with all races and all player characters, there must of course be monsters to fight, Cole. And as said, the original concept of D&D was based off tabletop war games, but eventually focused more and more on the individual stories of a smaller party of player characters, as well as their trials against evil monsters. Inspiration for these monsters came from a variety of sources, such as Tolkien and Vance, as well as mythological creatures like dragons and medusas, and even the infamous gelatinous cube, seemingly based off something as mundane as Jell-O.
Gelatinous cube is still one of the... I consider the gelatinous cube the meme monster. But also...
Yeah, I definitely.
It's so powerful.
It is!
At low levels, it's just kind of that thing of, you better have a magic weapon, because if not, your weapon's just going to rot, or rust, or whatever, mm-hmm. in like 5 rounds.
Yeah, it's hard to see, and once you're in it, it's hard to get out of it, especially at lower levels, and it's a really dangerous threat to a young or early on party, especially of inexperienced players. And I think that really goes to show that something inspired by something as innocuous and ordinary as a cube of Jell-O is one of the most popular monsters in Dungeons and Dragons, even up there with the titular dragons.
Yeah, but what other fancy monsters were in the original D&D?
Well, you do have stuff like dragons and medusas that have evolved in lore and mechanics since then, and you have interesting mechanics like, you may not have known this, armor class in the early editions was actually better the lower it got.
It was Thaco.
So you could...
to hit armor class zero.
Yeah.
I remember the tables. Mm-hmm. Yes, trust me, my love of nostalgia, I've attempted to play with the graphs of the first and second edition D&D. Man, it's a time just reading. Yeah.
And of course you have other famous monsters like the Beholder, which was just an original creation by those original players, and was something as simple as a ball with eyes, and other monsters inspired by famous literature and sci-fi literature from the time, like the Mind Flayers, and just monsters that have stuck around from very lesser-known inspiration and have really come into a place where they're more known nowadays for their inclusion in Dungeons & Dragons. Like you get the Mind Flayer in Stranger Things, which is, you know, it's famous in the show for its inclusion in D&D.
Yeah, I was going to say, basically every single villain in Dungeons & Dragons is because it's a D&D character they're facing in a campaign at the very beginning of the season. They've been very good at structuring the villains like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just a brief bit of history around Dungeons & Dragons and how it stuck around so long, but bringing it back to the modern day, as with things like Stranger Things and Critical Role and Activision Acquisitions Incorporated, media like that has really brought Dungeons & Dragons into the spotlight. And with 5th edition, it has seen a massive growth like it's never seen before. So I want to ask you, Cole, what about Dungeons and Dragons attracts you, do you think? What keeps you coming back to the game when nowadays there are so many other systems like Vampire the Masquerade, Call of Cthulhu, other systems? What do you think keeps you coming back to D&D?
Well, I've played the other ones. Like, I've played Call of Cthulhu before. I've played, like, Cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that, especially 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, you have the different source books. You have, like, the Mythic Odyssey of Theros. You have the Magic the Gathering source books. You have the one for Eberron. It does a really good job at just kind of setting universes for you to operate your campaigns in and giving you a good... and giving you a good backdrop. I think that's what kind of keeps me coming back to it, is for the for the ease of play. I know we talk about the difference between like using a module or using like a homebrew. I definitely believe that 5th edition specifically is just the easiest one I've found to homebrew a story and a setting and run it. Like, I've found really good modules for, you know, Call of Cthulhu has some pre-written stories. D&D has pre-written modules. Pretty sure I played one for the Cyberpunk 2020. But yeah, they all have pre-written modules that are pretty good. But I think the ease with which you can make your own story is something that is heavily favored in 5e.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. I was thinking much of the same thing, that you see with the ease of play, you go back to the early editions or even something as recent as 4th edition, and there are all these different modifiers and all these rules to keep track of, and they come up in every scenario and everything is so detailed, which a lot of people like. They're like, if you, quick shout out to another podcast, the Dungeon Cast, William on the Dungeon Cast. Talks a lot about how 4th edition was a very detailed system. And that can scare a lot of people away, but for people who like the stats and like the strict numbers, like Gygax in the early days, it's comforting to, I guess comforting or interesting, to be able to plot everything out so exactly. And you can do that in 5th edition. You have the freedom to really throw in whatever you want. And as 5th edition has continued and 5.5 is on some horizon in the future.
Is it going to be 5.5 or 6th edition?
I've heard 5.5. I've heard 5.5 okay. is what's coming next. Cannot confirm. Do not cite me. But
I won't.
Thank God. But whatever comes next, it seems that the direction it's going with this real success that 5e has brought is just the ability to play how you want to play and tell the story that you want to tell. And I think that's personally what keeps me coming back, is the ability as a DM to tell whatever story I want in whatever setting I want. Obviously, you know that I have my setting that I DM in, and you have your settings that you DM in. And even as a player with a good DM, any good DM will be willing to cooperate with you and help you tell the story that you want to tell with your character. And like, I remember Liam O'Brien, one of the cast members of Critical Role, said that Dungeons & Dragons is just the best storytelling device out there, because they're the only restrictions you have to the story you can tell is how far the other people at the table want to go with it. Because it is a group activity, of course, but yeah. You get to tell that story with your friends.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's a plus to it, is that you do have almost that complete freedom to go wherever mm-hmm. you want with a story. But I do appreciate kind of what you're saying, the team aspect of the group
yeah.
that also wants to go yeah. through with their story. And I mean, that's really something that's just important for any tabletop RPG that you're playing mm-hmm. is really knowing everyone's bounds and limits when it comes to your sessions and the campaign. Like, I know specifically, I think it was in Tasha's, there was kind of the rules, like 10 rules to follow to kind of have a successful campaign. Mm-hmm. And one of them was know your player's limits and, you know what each player thinks is too far in a certain thing.
Yes.
And I definitely think that, and I won't say this is always a great thing to do, because I think D&D provides for a, like, not risky way to, you know, kind mm-hmm. of compromise with people, or, like, a way that doesn't really have any impact in compromising yeah. with people on things. But also, if you're not cool with the direction the campaign's taking, or, mm-hmm. you know, you aren't cool with the same amount of stuff that other people are, you can't step away from it. And, I mean, we've seen it before. The first campaign we play, we had people going in and out of that all the time.
Yes.
But I know that just because a recent experience for me was I was playing an artificer that was an artillerist, and my friend had kind of adapted 5th edition to work for kind of like an Old West kind of style campaign, using kind yeah. of the firearms thing in the DMG. And my artificer, something that people kind of weren't okay with, but we kind of figured out a way to work it into the story better,
mm-hmm.
was that I wanted my artificer to be addicted to morphine. As he was kind of a mad scientist that, again, mm-hmm. the artificer was an artillerist, so he worked with, like, bombs, fire, and everything. So in doing that, we kind of came up with a story, and the players were okay with it because they kind of helped my artificer kind of start to wean off of it and kind of take me through yeah. kind of a drug rehab themselves. So, I mean, that originally that wasn't something that they really wanted to have in the campaign, was drugs, mm. but we compromised and we agreed to something that I think ultimately benefited the story, because in the yeah. beginning, we're all perfect strangers to each other. And that was just one of those things of bonding through this campaign, not being a party that, you know, knows each other and just happens to all sit down in a tavern at the beginning. I think it was something that really helped bring everyone together, because even though it was a sensitive yeah. topic, we all compromised and built a story that made our characters and our team infinitely better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree. Like, I think the mark of a good dungeon master or player is how much you are how much the rest of the table is having fun at the table, how much of the rest of your friends are having fun. And like, you may not do the big voices, you may not draw or put out the expansive maps and everything, but if your table is having fun doing silly stuff like seducing the dragon or robbing the local merchant, then you're doing it right. You're doing it right. But on that note, I think that's a great transition into the next question, the next topic being the dungeon master and the player. We talked a little bit about different DMing and playing styles, but Cole, we've talked about this between ourselves. Would you say you have a preference for DMing or for playing, if any preference?
I definitely have a preference more towards playing than I do DMing, because the way I like to play is having a complex backstory and like character development and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
While the way I DM, I mean, you've kind of seen it before. I'm one of those that would just bring out the deck of many things in like the first two sessions.
Yes.
I really like to play, if I'm DMing, just kind of play it fast and loose, kind of let them do what they want. Yeah. Not really have an altogether story and just kind of go with it on the go. I'm one that throws in like references to pop culture everywhere, and I'm just like, sure, I can make a campaign just off of every single movie, book, and TV show that I've ever, you know, seen, read, or whatever. And that's kind of how I take the approach to DMing. And
I mean, in doing so, you're doing the same as Gygax and the rest of the forefathers of D&D, just taking whatever elements you want from inspiration.
Yeah. And I'm like, so I kind of, I'm still definitely more of a player, but I definitely say with other D&D podcasts, I've really gotten into Dimension 20 and Brendan Lee Mulligan, the College Humor cast. And I really like the way they do it. One thing I do want to improve on is, of course, having more story. I think that would make it more fun for me as a DM. But I still like that. Yeah. I feel like compared to Critical Role, I think they play it a bit more fast and loose and more casual, which is definitely what I look for in an experience if I'm running a game. I don't want to take it too seriously.
Sure. Yeah, I'd agree. We've talked about before how you have the more story-driven playing style and the more fast and loose dungeon crawl kind of DMing style. I would say that I'm a bit of a mix between mechanical and storytelling side. As a DM, I think I do prefer DMing, and that's why we make such good friends, that I always have a campaign for you to play.
You always do. I think I've joined every single campaign you've done except for one.
You've certainly made a cameo in all of them to some extent.
That's amazing.
But as a DM, I'm obsessed with building up a setting and having very complex stories that I really have to pull myself back on when it comes to, okay, how am I going to explain every bit of backstory for this villain to the players? And I remember with the Triumvirate campaign that I'm running right now, which is one I've told you a lot about, I remember in the early days, I had come up with so much backstory for this organization that they're up against that I actually had a problem throwing the backstory at them because it was so much to handle. And my players are great. They love all the backstory. They love learning more secrets. And it takes a lot from me to be like, okay, how do I tell this info to them in a way that will make sense and that will stick with them? And I think, in getting better as a DM, you know, it's a way to practice storytelling. If you want to be an author, if you want to be an actor, if you want to be a writer of any kind, a creator of any kind, D&D is a great way to do that. I think that's another thing that brings a lot of people back to Dungeons & Dragons is it's practice, it's improv, it's storytelling. It is a way to take a story seriously as you want or as goofy as you want and do it amongst friends and just a, it is a great creative outlet.
Yeah, and I definitely think that going back to kind of the working on stories, if you want to get into writing or any kind of creative outlet like that, D&D is a good place to work, especially on characters. Because I can say it right now, in the campaigns I've played in, there have been those where it's like, you know, setting is important and kind of, you know, what's the government around you? What are these cities? Where is there snow, certain types of trees, whatever? You really learn what's important doing campaigns. In my opinion, I really think that the best campaigns kind of shun away from really any specificity in terms of the setting and really push more towards characters and bringing in kind of important people to interact with the party. So a lot of them will be like, oh yeah, let's say you go into this empire with a dictator instead of like flowing out the entire government and how his government kind of works to use in some political intrigue part of the campaign. The best stories I've seen are like, here's this governor's backstory and like, what are his motivations? What can you use against him? That kind of stuff. And I really think that that's kind of the role of the DM, is more providing first characterization for their own creations and then opportunities for characterization for the players, because that's what really drives the campaign. And like you were saying, you don't have to put out like the crazy maps. Some of the best campaigns I've done have just kind of been in the palace of the mind. It's just in our own heads what we see. And so even with that, if you don't have like your pieces or a map of anything, even then the setting isn't the primary focus. It's the people or the monsters that you're interacting with.
Yeah, the example I always like to give to new players is like when you've laid out this story for a new campaign and the party meets in the starting town and they hear the town crier shouting out, "The princess has been captured by the dragon. Meet with the town guard captain to find more information." And the players go, the DM wants us to go talk about that dragon. But we want to open a bar. DM, where can we find a property to open a bar?" And
open
just come
bar.
You expected a campaign with a dragon. You expected a campaign with a dragon, and you're instead playing a campaign with town politics and competing businesses and whatever monsters infest the basement of the party's new tavern.
See, that's
you wouldn't know anything about
that,
Cole, would you?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about. But I was gonna say that's why you send in the dragon polymorphed as the human and just go like, "Hold on, I have contacts. I thought these people were going to come kill me. Why have they opened the bar?"
Yes. They've got staves and swords, but they're making beer. This isn't right.
One of the DMs that I've played with, while I was off at college, he loved to kind of take, you know, the broad setting things and just use a tavern generator online that had, like, different drinks and, you know, like, one or two like special like little story hooks in there. I think that was one of the greatest things he used, because I think one of the best times I ever had in the tavern was I walked into the tavern and he's like, "Here's this list of drinks," and he was like, "Yeah, here's like this little flask or whatever, it's like 2 gold or something." I'm like, "That's expensive for something in a tavern. Usually not, they don't cost gold." But it was a very small, like, teardrop-shaped flask that you poured into a mug, and it was like a nonstop thing of, like, basically grain alcohol. So the best time I had was doing that with my character. And, of course, this was my ranger who just happened to be like all bards and try to seduce anything. But the best time was he made me roleplay the drunkenness of my character, and Then I went into a terrible karaoke rendition of Piano Man.
Good.
Yes, as any good campaign does, it really just derails as soon as you get in the tavern. Any notion that the story's going to continue is just out of anyone's head for the next hour.
Yes.
But yeah, on that note, everyone should use a tavern generator, or at least flesh out your taverns above anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Because you will be spending more time than you think in that tavern.
Probably, yeah.
If not an entire session in that tavern.
Yeah. Well, Cole, we've talked a lot about the things we love about D&D and what keeps us coming back to D&D and where it all has come from.
Oh no, you're going to the dark side now.
Oh yes. Now I think I want to talk a little bit about, maybe not complaints, but things we would change. What are some things about D&D 5th edition that you would want to see changed in later editions? Any complaints that you would want to see rectified?
More magic weapons.
Yeah.
I think published by Wizards of the Coast. I think that they mm-hmm. would be good just to have a source book or something yeah. like it, just of more magic items. One thing I've run into in a lot of campaigns is that there are very unique swords
mm-hmm.
for everything, but it's like, this has to be a sword that does slashing damage and all of mm-hmm. those things. And I'm just like, I know you can kind of just like scrap that and say, I don't care. I'm the dungeon master. I can do what I want.
Right.
But I wish that there were more options that were like made to be kind of those kinds of weapons from the beginning. Like, I can't remember any magical spears that are at least in the Dungeon Master's Guide.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's always that small group in like the modules of specific magic weapons.
Yeah.
But like, piercing weapons are always shorthanded for magical ones. So are bludgeoning weapons. Like, there's no magical clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one. There's no magical crossbows that isn't just, you know, like a plus something weapon.
Crossbows and bows are like strangely missing from the magic item lists.
Yeah, the few that you have, I think, is like the oath bow.
Yeah, or the luck
bow. And maybe like one more bow. But they're strangely missing. I think that's probably my biggest complaint.
Mm-hmm.
That, and then I don't think it's really a complaint. I think it's just my own hot take on it. I've just never found luck with the paladins as a class. I just said this,
and I find it strange.
I just absolutely hate playing paladins.
But you love rangers.
So you just haven't played rangers since they made them epically crazy after Tasha's.
Apparently.
You basically throw out everything that's in the player's handbook for a ranger and take everything in Tasha's. And you get, I think, what's one of the best, most well-rounded characters that you mm-hmm. that you can have in a class. My problem with paladins is that, and I don't think it's from really the perspective of playing a paladin,
mm-hmm.
but I think that paladins are kind of meant to be like the tank slash do damage slash heal if they have to.
Yeah.
And I think that really takes away just from the general power of the paladin, is having to split between those. So in my opinion, I don't see the paladin as really a useful class.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have like a party of like five or six.
Right.
Because I think there are better uses, you know, if you're trying to get that like perfect group of three or four to where you encompass everything that you really need.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a paladin just kind of throws a wrench into that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Cole, you've praised rangers and you've told paladins to screw off. If we weren't canceled last episode, we will be canceled this episode. So as a way to bring things back, bring our loyal audience back in, I think we should go with the old reliable of complaining about dark vision.
Hey, I don't complain about dark vision.
I do.
Just because I always play a character with dark vision. So
I know you do. So for those of you who don't know at home, dark vision is pretty much what it says on the tin. It's a special sense that you can see out to a certain range in dim light or darkness to a certain level, and essentially you see things in gray tone. So you see things without color, you see vague images, and The weirdest thing about Dark Vision, and we've talked about this as well, Cole, the weirdest thing about Dark Vision is the fact that more races in 5th edition have it than those that don't. In this setting, if you go by the books, you are more likely to be able to see well at night than not being able to see well at night, which is weird. It's one of the things in a fantasy setting that should drastically change how everything works. And obviously you don't have to go into that kind of detail in your setting, but it's so weird. And if it's, I know there'll be people who say, oh, that's not really how Dark Vision works. It works like this. But I've never been able to find someone who can tell me how it works stably. Like, if it doesn't take away advantage in low light, then what does it do?
Well, from what I kind of know about it, is just the basics of it. It's supposed to work in black and white, and that the reason that it's more overpowered, I guess, than what it's intended to be, is because people just kind of assume everything is in color when they're seeing with Dark Vision.
Yeah.
Plus, doesn't Dark Vision have, like, a constraint to it where it's, like, seeing in, like, dim light from 30 to 60 feet or something?
It is. You can see in dim light as if it were bright light, and you can see in darkness as if it were dim light. And I have looked over the Dark Vision rules. I have looked over the darkness rules. I have looked over the obscurement rules and the blindness rules. I can't determine how it's meant to work mechanically.
No one understands what dim light is. That's the problem. I don't understand
what does it do mechanically? Means. Why is it mentioned mechanically if it doesn't do anything? Oh, Dark Vision's weird. I could have a whole solo 40-minute episode on it, I'm sure.
Yeah, trust me. That's one of those big mechanical issues that I think they just need a rehaul, or just a rehaul of how light works in general and sight.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I don't think the problem is just for Dark Vision. I think it's just for that entire using your eyes in 5th edition.
Yeah.
But, well, you have any other complaints about 5e?
I'm sure we can go into more, like, the weirdness with alignment is more of a story thing. It doesn't come in mechanically much. The difficulty in balancing encounters, like, especially for new DMs.
Balancing encounters is tough.
It is tough, yeah. Like, challenge rating is never a perfect fit for whatever size of party you're throwing it against, and you'd really just have to get experience, which is the best way to learn D&D, is just to play it. But in those early days, you're going to be wondering how many goblins is an appropriate fight for your party of four level threes. And it could be anywhere from 10 to 58.
It's 100% closer to 58.
Yeah, that's true. You got second level spells.
Because remember, while the mechanics may say that 58 goblins can easily defeat your party,
yes,
you're forgetting about the heart of all D&D players,
mm-hmm.
which is war crimes against goblins.
That's true.
I was going to say, I think that has been a secret mantra for each of my characters that I've ever played, is just war crimes against goblins.
It's a very officially unofficial rule.
They are just the low-level pests.
Yes.
Like bandits, you're like, all right, bandits deserve it because enough bandits could kill an entire party, especially early on. I've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. But goblins, really?
Yeah.
That's one thing I will never do as a DM. I will never throw in just a fight with goblins. They'll always be like a tertiary creature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Cole, I think this has been another excellent episode of our amazing podcast. We'll be expecting our Best Podcast Ever award in the mail any day now.
That's true, and I'd also like to give a shout out, just like we did last episode with Joe Rogan, Matt Mercer, if you're listening to this, sponsor us.
Please.
Please. Or at least come let us play Critical Role with you.
Yes. Invite us. I'll fly out tomorrow.
Yes. Oh, also other sponsor, because Again, lots of D&D podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know, you probably just type it in the Apple podcast and you can find quite a few.
Yeah.
Brendan Lee Mulligan or any person from College Humor, if you're also listening to this, let us come on
which
and
you definitely
do
are.
Some weird characters.
Just anybody, any famous DM, come onto our show and make silly voices, please. That's all we ask.
Yeah. Just anyone famous. Do famous things.
Well, I think that's another end to another great episode. And as a call to arms at this point, I'd like to invite our audience to tell us about your experience with Dungeons and Dragons. Do you prefer DMing, playing? What's your play style? What's your DMing style? If you've never played before, why not start?
True.
This is our own special cult, and we always like inviting people in.
Yep. Dungeons and Dragons is a game for all, and on Cad's point, put down in the comments, are you one to seduce the dragon? And I guess I'll leave it right there.
Yes. Are you the seducer or the seduced?
Yeah, are you the seducer or are you seduced? All right, well, I'm Cole Browning.
I'm Cad MacArthur.
You just listened to this podcast and prepare to be unquestionably nerdy. Good night, guys.
Good night.